right now, I believe we can go over and join Martin.
Oh, yes, indeed. I am indeed here in the parish church of Stamford Chimney, and with me is the warden of the church, Mr. Clifford Halliwell. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Now, this is not a new church, is it?
No.
No, no. Is it 18th century, Clifford?
No, it's Norman, in fact.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it 18th century, Norman?
The church is Norman.
Oh, I'm sorry, so, Clifford, how did you come to call the church Norman?
I didn't call the church Norman.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, no, silly me. It was probably called Norman hundreds of years ago. By the Normans, who knows?
It's a church of St. Little Bodies.
St. Little Bodies, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Norman little bodies, yes. Sounds rather like a circus midget, doesn't it? That's enough about churches, I think. Now, Clifford, you're the warden here, yes?
Yes.
Yes. And how many animals do you have to look after?
I'm a church warden.
Yes?
Not a game warden.
No, obviously, no. But how many animals do you have to look after?
I don't look after any animals.
No, but could you say that you do?
Why?
The penalty for attempting any kind of radio these days is that your every cliche is hurled back in your teeth by some team of sharp-eared ravers like the Radioactive Lot. Their parade of radio ineptitudes is only hilarious because it's based on the terrible truth. Not of this channel, naturally, but, well, you've heard the sort of stuff. One of the first things radio comedy did, if you can remember that far back in our story, was to lampoon itself, often picking on quite specific targets. A few years ago, I was guilty of this traditional sin myself, taking on a whole page of the Radio Times in a show called A Day in the Life of Radio 4. This is what Chris Emmett and I did, out of pure affection, of course, to Transatlantic Quiz.
This is Anthony Quinton in New York. Delabile dictu, we've reached round 17 of our transatlantic quiz, which means, if I'm not mistaken, Louis Allen in London, that we have already brought to a satisfactory conclusion 16 programs in the present series. I imagine this corresponds at least roughly with your own computations, Louis Allen.
In London, yes, it does, Tony Quinton, it does indeed. You are admirably precise in these matters, as always.
Well, it's most kind of you to say so. I do, of course, defer ultimately to you in all matters arithmetical. Speaking of which, it's probably worth interjecting at this point that the score in this primordial struggle between our combatants, at several stages during which one has been quite relieved that the Atlantic Ocean interposes itself between us, presently stands at 93.5 points to my New York team of Shayna Alexander and Brendan Gill of the New Yorker, and 93.25 points to our admirable London crew of Irene Thomas and John Julius Norwich. This being a more contentious item of information, I await your judgment with interest, Louis Allen in London.
Yes, Tony, hard though it is for us to admit to being so far behind, we must concur with your analysis of the situation for the time being.
Splendid. How's the weather in London? All right, is it?
Not bad, Tony. Very little precipitation. Just a touch of frost.
Well, I must say that's perfectly splendid to hear. Not too hard on the sciatica, very good. Well, without further ado, and with your permission, Louis Allen in London.
Carry on, Tony, by all means.
In that case, I shall broach the first question to the New York team. A question provided by a listener, Mr. R. Scruton of London. If Hitler had one, Goebbels had none, and pawnbrokers were blessed with three, what was the score at halftime?
Well, thank goodness for people like Anthony Quinton, whose styles are so distinctive as to be irresistible to the parodist. We found that send-up of the network lying about in a BBC tape store covered in dust. And I suppose it was too much to expect that the official archive would welcome it. But as well as cannibalising itself, BBC radio comedy in recent years has often enjoyed playing around with things that are officially outside the corporation's brief. Advertising, for instance. No adverts on BBC radio, of course. But that only increases the comic's desire to get his hands on the styles and conventions of the ad man's jingle. There was a radio sitcom about advertising nearly 30 years ago. Something to Shout About, that was called. But the act of ad simulation was given a properly glossy finish just a few years ago by the show with the provocative title Legal, Decent, Honest, and Truthful.
I married a monster from Patsy and Satchy. Stimulating in advertising. Only the mad survive.
Yes, love.
Andy, you're being asked what you want for your pudding.
Oh, Loretta Jane Duff.
Just give him the trifle, preferably with double bromide.
What's the matter, Tom? You look worried.
It's my Derek, Sheila. I wish he was more like your Tom.
How do you mean?
Well, your Tom's so clean and sexless. My Derek's really dirty, clinging, stubborn filth. That's all he thinks about.
You should give him bromo.
Bromo?
The washing powder for men. Put a spoonful of bromo in Derek's tea. Bromo gets deep down into his hormones, where the dirt and filth form. Hey, presto, his mind comes up pure and clean.
Oh, thanks, Sheila. Now I've discovered bromo, I'll sleep easy in my bed.
That's all you're doing, Beth, pal.
Miriam Margolyes, Sally Grace, Martin Jarvis, and David Tate in Legal, Decent, Honest, and Truthful. That was perhaps a rather formal way of flirting with impermissible radio material. There weren't going to be any real ads to break the rules. The late-night programme In One Ear had a more realistic chance to conduct the same flirtation because In One Ear was a live comedy show. I seem to remember it was greeted as the first fully live comedy on radio since the early Goons. Anyway, In One Ear, featuring Steve Brown, Helen Lederer, Clive Mantle and Nick Wilton, did go out live, and the only edits in it were the ones demanded by the BBC Charter.
This is danger time. Okay, there are certain words you don't normally hear on Radio 4. We said most of those words in this series, but there's one word we haven't said yet, and that's... See? There you go. There you go. It's nothing really. The ultimate taboo.
Right, and tonight we're going to go the whole way.
It's really easy.
Nobody can stop it.
But of course, there's no point in just using the words in isolation. I mean, we can use them in sentences, like,
Or...
And the reason we can say all of these is... Because every time we use the bad, naughty, naughty word, Jamie the producer just pulled the plug. You said none of these words actually went out, did they, Jay?
Okay, we're set up. We're ready to do the swearing sketch. Off you go.
There is something peculiarly panic-making about dead air over the radio, isn't there? And if you just tuned in, don't worry, there's nothing wrong with us here, you there, or the transmitter in between. It's just the In One Ear team playing around with the notion of saying unacceptable things like... Oh, Joe, I needed that. Young iconoclasts among you will no doubt say it's simply coy to pretend to be naughty, and that in reality nothing's changed behind Auntie's studio curtains since the days of the Radio Variety Code, when there were no bigger jokes, no underwear jokes, lodgers, honeymooners, brand names, or parts of the body. Well, the other week I was listening in the bath to Digents Does It Locally, and it struck me that no, some things really have changed.
This week we are in Stoke.
Right, now, who lives here, then?
Or lives here? I'll tell you, Reginald Mitchell from Kidsgrow. Is he here?
He designed a Spitfire, still used by British Midland Airways. As you all know, in this series, I'm following the footsteps from town to town of my great-great-granddad, Long Dick Digents, the pirate, in search of his hidden treasure. And most of you have written in and seeming to think, you're more concerned anyway, with how he got his name. Well, I don't know. I just wish he ran in the family.
It's still coy for some advanced tastes, I suppose, but imagine the howls of horror and calamity if that had gone out through the fretwork sunburst speakers of 1936. The wrath of Rhys would have been resplendent. Tastes among listeners still do vary a great deal, though, and there are sometimes cries of foul from older people or interested groups. Blasphemy is one sensitive area. Plenty of license payers feel that God's sense of humour is not the most robust of his creations. And there's been the odd celebrated court case in the libel area, although finding real malice in radio comedy seems generally to have been a lost cause. So all in all, if improvisatory comedy is thriving at the moment, which it seems to be, it's not because of the excitement of wondering what terrible things they're going to say next, but rather, I think, a question of matching one's own wits against the broadcasters. Facing the same challenge that's put to these young comedy sparks, how would you do?
Could the little senior acting out be landing a plane in a crisis? If Jimmy, you could be the pilot, and Stephen, you're the ground crew, trying to talk him down. So you could start off just in any style, and then members of the audience would be thinking of other styles for you to go into, like a western or a musical or Shakespeare, something like that, some sort of theatre style like that. And on you go.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. Experiencing difficulties coming into land, please advise.
Yes, have you done one of these before?
Funny you should mention that, no.
And a style. Pantomime, I heard pantomime from the front there.
What? I think I've got that correct, boys and girls. I think I am. Oh, sorry. Oh, yes, I am. Look behind you. There should be a knob. Oh.
It isn't really a theatre style. Gangster, from...
Okay, well, here, I've got the play here. I've got to put it somewhere. Where are you going to put it?
Huh? Wait, what's the needle say, eh?
The needle says 2,000 feet.
2,000 feet?
And dropping, it's dropping.
It's dropping?
It's dropping.
Where am I going to get rid of 2,000 feet wholesale?
I don't know.
Clive Anderson, Stephen Fry, and Jimmy Mulville in Whose Line Is It Anyway? A show that achieved an odd kind of extra notoriety recently when the TV rights were acquired not by the BBC, but by a commercial company. Well, accidents will happen. Unfortunately, the same one happened to this next show as well. Even though its leading players, Prunella Scales and Joan Sanderson, are among the most famously dependable faces in TV situation comedy. That After Henry wasn't immediately seized on by the BBC had, I imagine, something to do with the very purity of the programme as radio. Played without an audience and prepared to let dialogue run naturally without the obligation to go lurching after a laugh line every other utterance, Simon Brett's scripts didn't strive in the way TV comedy always does strive, and so possibly might be mistaken for something other than comedy, though I doubt it.
Look, when you come to dinner, for heaven's sake,
there's... Who comes to dinner, dear?
Julian. Oh.
Julian coming to dinner? You're inviting him, Sarah?
Yes.
Well, I look forward to that.
Ah, Granny.
Yes, Claire, dear?
I don't want you to be there.
What, dear?
You heard what I said.
I don't think I heard it correctly, dear.
Yes, you did. I don't want you to come to dinner when Julian's here.
But why ever not, Claire? You're afraid I'm going to let the side down?
Yes.
What?
Granny, I know exactly what you'll be like. You'll patronise me and keep bringing up embarrassing incidents from when I was a child.
Sarah, what an idea. I wouldn't do that. Sarah, I appeal to you. Have I ever done anything like that?
Pass. Granny, it's just I want this to be a civilised, intelligent, adult evening.
Oh, really? Are you suggesting that I don't know how to hold my own in... civilized, intelligent, adult company?
No, I'm not...
Are you suggesting that I'd be struck dumb when the conversation got a bit intellectual?
No, I'm suggesting the exact opposite, and that's why I don't want you there.
Thank you very much.
Come on, Granny, you thought Schopenhauer was a composer.
Goodness, Claire, can't you tell when I'm joking?
Yes, I can, Granny, and you weren't joking then.
Of course I knew he wasn't a composer.
Oh, right, what was he?
Well, with a man of such varied talents, it's invidious to single out one particular ability.
You haven't a clue.
You know?
No.
I mean, I'm very hurt, Claire.
Well, Mother, there'll be other chances for you to meet Julian. Let Jeremy just have his one dinner with him first, you know, so that he gets to know one member of the family at a time.
You mean break the bad news to him gently?
Yes.
Claire.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, it's just, Claire, listen, we know how much you care about Julian, but if he's the sort of person he seems to be, he's not going to be put off by the fact that we aren't in his family's intellectual league.
Speak for yourself.
Mother.
Just because I don't flaunt my intellect, it doesn't mean I haven't got any.
Claire isn't saying that you haven't got any, Mother.
Still, if Claire's afraid I'm going to let down the family image, I can take a hint. I know when I'm not wanted.
Mother.
Oh, sharper than the serpent's tooth it is to have an ungrateful child, as Milton put it.
After Henry. One thing you have to say about the kind of radio comedy that follows the traditions of audience-free wireless drama, it certainly aims for the same standards of production and casting as serious drama always gets. When Sue Lim came up with the initially curious idea of a series sending up the cult of Wordsworth, and indeed the whole lore, language and notoriety of the romantic poets, it was clear she was unlikely to get away with it unless her gargoyle versions of these great men and long-suffering women were played by top-class actors. In fact, the same caliber of performer who would be called upon if a serious biography of these figures were being put on. Here's how William and Dorothy Wordsmith suffered the interruption of their Lakeland idyll by the notorious Lord Byron.
Miss Wordsmith, I abase myself before you.
Oh, please do not, my lord. William and I do not care for that sort of thing.
Indeed. I'm sorry to have to inform you, Byron, that circumstances prevent our extending towards you the hospitality we should have wished.
I fear I have overstepped the mark as usual. Miss Wordsmith, as I stagger back ice into the night... As I fling my tattered cloak around my aching shoulders and stoop to one last burning glance of anguish intercession.
My God!
All I ask is that, Miss Wordsmith, you should remember me.
Hello, your ladyship.
Ah, your rustic friend is returned.
What is it?
It's Lord Byron's house, your ladyship. There's a poor suffering creature in there. And brings me out with us to hear the weeping and wailing she's a raping.
A poor suffering creature?
Why, Mahomet, I had forgotten. A young Italian cousin of mine, Miss Wordsmith.
Teresa Sanmastereria.
A cousin?
Yes. And my mother's stepsister's half-daughter. My cousin twice removed and twice replaced. She is, I'm afraid, in some distress of body.
Oh, dear, nothing serious, I trust.
Women troubled anyway, I believe, must I? Vapors, stains, tintypes, that sort of thing.
I shall call my maid.
Your maid? Please do.
The Wordsmiths at Dorsmere, with Simon Callow as Coleric, Tim Curry as Wyro, and Geoffrey Whitehead and Denise Coffey as the Wordsmiths. There are some comedy performers, a small number, who seem to have no trouble hopping out of a narrative, doing a momentary gag in their own guise, and resuming the flow of narrative again. And still preeminent among these on radio is Roy Hudd. It's hard to say quite what his award-winning show Hudwinks is, except that it is a vehicle for exploiting just this mobility of Hudd's, which is swift enough even to allow for a historical critique of the jokes as they go by.
I must prove to my father that I'm a man, a real man, and I've told him straight. If I fail to conquer every, then he can cancel my being over from the news station.
Well, don't think you're going without me, Compton.
What?
Oh, I've heard about these Sherpa women, all slant eyes and sleeping bags. I'm coming with you.
Melissa, are you insane? Why, the ambient temperature on the upper ridges is at least 50 below. You'll never withstand it.
Compton, you're talking to someone who once spent a fortnight in Scarborough. Evidently just the same, but not quite as image.
Don't you realise? It's like Cliff Richard's bedroom. It's no place for a woman.
The argument swung to and fro. First it was Cliff Richard's legal advisers, and then it was us.
If Roy Hudd is the friendly face that carries forward the red-nosed tradition in the South, then the comedy department in Manchester presents a veritable battery of roseate conks, most of them belonging to the Grumbleweeds. There's nothing you can say about the Grumbleweeds that hasn't been said in a Jimmy Savile accent, so here they are.
Hello there, Peggy. Have you seen Walter Gabriel today?
Now then, all these wonderful ladies and gentlemen, what's in there? Why, you're wearing his gas mask.
Hate to stop me picking your nose.
Now then, the burning question, does it work?
No, I can get my hand up the side.
They're grumbleweeds. And as a matter of historical fact, that was the first radio trail they ever recorded in 1978. And they're still recognisably true to their code. But where's the avant-garde in all this? Is there nobody who's prepared to get out there and challenge people's tastes and preconceptions, to risk losing listeners by being aggressive and even offensive once in a while? Well, you have to remember there's nothing in the BBC Charter that specifically asks for this. Inform, educate and entertain, yes, but there's nothing about the duty to offend. And for another thing, the Radio 4 audience, and we're talking mainly of shows produced for Radio 4 and 2, Radio 4 listeners are so fierce in their insistence on what they do and don't want that it's almost more than a comic's job's worth to annoy them. In spite of which, just now and again, there's a show that will stand up and ask to be counted.
At this point in the show, there was supposed to be a thing called insulting the audience. Because you see, Jimmy at the back, Jimmy went to America recently and he saw this comedian who insulted the audience and everyone fell around laughing. And of course, Jimmy thought it would be a great idea to do it here. And of course, I'm up here doing it. Apparently, it is very funny because I'm up here on stage. I'm very rude indeed and abusive to this one person. And all the rest of the audience fall about with laughter and say, thank God it's not me. Except, of course, you. No, not me. It's you. All right, you. You laugh along as well, of course, sometimes, to show you're a good sport. And you don't mind being called, well, you are quite overweight, aren't you? But you're probably on a diet. You see, in England, we think it's ultimately sad that old Facto here should have a face like the backside of the moon and a bald girlfriend. At least I assume it's his girlfriend sitting next to him. At least, if it isn't, I get to know one another because a couple of freaks like you are just made for each other, really.
Perhaps the idea really was better suited to the Americans after all. Martin Bergman, one of the young cast of Injury Time, which also included, in 1980, Jimmy Mulville and Emma Thompson. That was what you might call a solo routine rather than a stand-up act. With a real stand-up comedian, now as 50 years ago, you're always slightly more at the mercy of the performer than you are at other times. The main difference nowadays being that your stand-up man doesn't have to be a man anymore.
Hello and welcome back to the Cabaret Upstairs, Radio 4's tentative look at the exciting world of fringe or alternative comedy, or as the BBC likes to call it, low-budget entertainment. Now, there are always quite a number of male stand-up comedians on the cabaret circuit, but despite the strong rule against any form of sexism, there are rather few stand-up female comedians or comediennes or fluffy little comedianettes. Don't you love the dear things, as Ben Elton calls them? But we can put that right away because our first act is a female comedian. I'd like everyone here in the comedy store to clap and cheer wildly to give her a great welcome and to irritate everyone listening at home with their transistors pressed their ears. But here she is, Hattie Heyridge.
Thank you very much. Hello. Pass it on. I was an only child. Still am. I never played with anybody when I was little. Not even myself. I was so lonely I invented 6 imaginary brothers and sisters. Hated them. I used to like playing kiss chase at primary school. You know, the girls run and the boys chase after them and kiss them. I was a romantic. I never used to run. All the boys ran straight past. Well, because I had imaginary brothers. They told them I got the clap.
Recorded at the comedy store, the cabaret upstairs, punching more holes in the old green book of prohibited topics. Every young comedian these days, it seems, has somewhere in her locker the kind of monologue Lenny Bruce wouldn't have been entirely displeased with, and no doubt in the end radio will broadcast such material uncut. But having arrived now in the present day, we find radio comedy in a stock-taking phase, not just in this programme, but in repeats of such classics as The Hitchhiker's Guide, and I'm sorry, I'll read that again, and in the sales of tapes of those and other shows. It would be unhealthy, perhaps, if new classics weren't simultaneously in the making, as they surely are. Well, there's always something in preparation. And producer Richard Wilcox currently has high hopes of a show you'll be hearing next year called Inside Sasha. It's a surreal journey through the body, with elements of throwback to the Goons, he says. And as you can hear from this unedited sneak preview, from the studio audience's point of view, not all the fun was derived strictly from the script.
Just shut up, this.
Yes, Comrade Sasha.
You are charged with eating Comrade Gorbachev's accordion. How do you plead?
Not guilty. You cannot prove anything. I deny eating the accordion. I should never eat an accordion. I eat.
Very well, very well. You may sit down.
Guilty, guilty. Take that man away.
The court is determined to make an example of Sasha's dissident eating habits, and he's given the cruelest sentence under Soviet justice. Sasha is forced to spend the rest of his days in East Acton. It is here that Sasha seeks medical help from a hospital doctor.
Ah, good morning, doctor.
Hello, doctor.
It's a good leading start,
isn't it? Inside Sasha, getting itself together for transmission in 1989, with John Glover, Jeffrey Holland, Nicola McAuliffe, and Christopher Rudzicki. Whether that show becomes one of the greats, an automatic choice for inclusion by the next person to tell the story of radio comedy in years to come, depends entirely on you and whether you laugh. But if you don't, they'll all be back trying again, like the heroic Ivor Cutler, who claims he hasn't been let loose on Radio 4 since 1959. He should soon be back in a show called King Cutler. Two shows in 30 years. It's one of the BBC's occasional series again. Away you go, Ivor.
The title of the song is an old Lowland Scots greeting, Jump in the Clyde. Moon, moon, sing for the moon, take your trumpet and play a tune. Da 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 da. Walking along the horny soil, trumpet by his side, ha ha. Picking at the grass till the clean shines out, makes his lips go wide. Moon, moon, sing to the moon, take your trumpet and play a tune. Da 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 da. The moon is black and green tonight, the dust is pitted and warm. Although I'm born in Scotland, I feel that I am born. Bum, bum, bum. Moon, moon, sing to the moon, take your trumpet and play a tune. Da 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 da. Found a cave and made a fire, boiled a piece of toast. Jump in the Clyde and roll like mad, I'll meet you at the coast. Moon, moon, sing to the moon, take your trumpet and play a tune. Da 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 da.
Enjoy that. So did I, funnily enough. And that is the story of Radio Fun from...
Hello, everybody.
All the way to... Goodbye now.
Russell Davis, Ration, presented Radio Fun. The series was produced by Neil Cargill.